Hi, everybody. This is Danny Fisher, and you're listening to the Buddhist Studies Podcast. Well, if this is your second round with the podcast, welcome back. If you're new to the podcast, welcome. I hope if you're new to the podcast, you'll go back and listen to the first episode. Unfortunately, I think the way I've structured the podcast for the book that we're using, Buddhist Religions, A Historical Introduction, the fifth edition by Richard H. Robinson, Willard L. Johnson, and Tanisaro Bhikkhu, it's going to work better if you sort of follow it sequentially. I think I've not structured this in the beginning very well to function as sort of a drop-in podcast. So if you see the title is Dogen or Kagyu Tibetan Buddhism or something, it probably won't work very well just to drop in to get the fundamentals on those topics. It will be based on much that's come before it. I hope in the future maybe I can figure out a way to do this so that it works more as a drop-in if that's something people want, but I have no idea if that's something you want. If that sounds like an interesting idea to you, you can let me know at the blog, in the comments. And if you have ideas about something you might like me to try in the future with this podcast, please let me know. But most of all, welcome. I have a few notes. I think I'll probably start the podcast with a collection of notes, to, among other things, point out relevant discussions or articles or information about things that we've explored previously or will explore soon. I think we'll also need to make room for mistakes and corrections. Hopefully there won't be major mistakes or corrections, but much like a newspaper or magazine, if those aren't too grandiose in terms as comparisons, we'll want to sort of acknowledge little errors or corrections along the way. And also, hopefully we can find ways to segue into what we'll be doing today. We'll take something that's maybe in the ether and start there. And I think I have a good one today. The first note would be, I apologize to all of you for the delay on getting the latest podcasts out here. Among other things, I was involved with the very first Buddhist Geeks conference, which was held at University of the West, where I work. I was a participant. I led a workshop on chaplaincy. And I was also working with some of our students as a volunteer for the Buddhist Geeks to sort of help them with things in the preparation and execution of the conference. So I was very interested in a lot of the dialogue that's been kind of happening on the internet about the conference in the last few days. I thought the event was really productive and exciting and thought-provoking. We had the lineup of speakers that the Geeks had previously announced, and then we had some surprise participants like Jack Kornfield came and was a panelist for one of the first panels that we had on Saturday. But anyway, I've been interested in a lot of the conversation, and among others, I really liked a blog post that was done by a participant at the conference. Or, he was in attendance for it. His name is David Chapman, and his blog is meaningness.wordpress.com. And in light of everything that we talked about last week regarding essentialism, inclusionism, how to address the plurality of Buddhist traditions and schools, David reminded us all, I think, of a great quote from the Buddhist scholar Robert Scharf. And Robert Scharf is a Buddhologist whose area is sort of medieval Chinese Buddhism. And he was interviewed, I don't remember how long ago it was, by Tricycle. I'll have the information in the bibliography for this post. But it was a great quote. Not only did it sort of capture something about the conference that Vince Horn, the Buddhist Geek CEO, pointed out, which was that it functioned more as a conversation, and conversations are important as you think about things like what the Buddhist geeks term the emerging face of Buddhism. In terms of our work at this podcast, I think Scharf offers an interesting rubric for thinking about Buddhist religions and pluralism in Buddhism that's important for us to look at. And that's thinking of Buddhism or Buddhisms as a conversation or series of conversations, I suppose. And I wanted to read what it was that that Scharf said in this interview with Tricycle. So Tricycle's question was, before you referred to Buddhism as a critique of all essences, including the idea that there is some essence in Buddhism that is transmitted over time. So then what is Buddhism? And Scharf's response is, one way of looking at Buddhism is as a conversation. And this conversation has been going on now for over 2,000 years, a long time. It is a conversation about what it is to be a human being, why we suffer, how we can resolve our suffering, what works, what doesn't, and so forth. These are big issues, and whichever one you choose to look at, you are not going to find a single Buddhist position. There have always been different positions, and these would be debated and argued. But all parties to the debate were presumed to share a common religious culture, a more or less shared world of texts, ideas, practices, without which there could be no real conversation. You are confronted with many answers that generate new sets of questions and perspectives, but it is important, I think, that we keep the conversation going here. It opens one up to dramatically different ways of understanding the world and our place in it. Through our participation, we help shape the conversation, and the conversation in turn shapes us. To abandon it would be to lose something precious. And you know, we've spoken about the authors of Buddhist religions settling on the term Buddhist religions and this idea of Buddhism as a family. And I really like, it's just something for us to sort of add to our mental file on this. Scharf's term here, conversation, and we could look at all these different traditions as holding this conversation that's so necessary to this thing that we, or set of things that we think of as Buddhism. So I just really liked it and was struck by that and was thinking a lot about what we're doing here as well as the Buddhist Geeks Conference and what I read. In terms of corrections and little mistakes from last week, I just wanted to point out, I pride myself on doing pronunciation well when it comes to Sanskrit and Pali and these languages. Pali I've studied, Sanskrit I've not, but I spend a lot of time looking at things that use a lot of Sanskrit terminology. I pride myself on being able to pronounce these terms and these words well, but I'm horrible when it comes to like German, French, anything that's not like a South Asian Buddhist language. I'm kind of lost at sea with. And I pronounced Jan Nadier, I pronounced it Nadier, and I have no idea if that's the correct pronunciation of it. So I just wanted to say, I hope that's correct, and if not, I'm certainly meant no disrespect by pronouncing it that way. I also made the mistake when I was talking about Eugene Burnouf and his ilk. I said two or three times 18th century when I meant 19th century. I had all the dates correct that I gave you for his publications and so forth, but I said 18th when I meant 19th. So I just wanted to clarify that. But it should have. Hopefully, it was obvious to you if you were following along, and you would notice the disparity there. I had one bibliography omission at the blog. I mentioned the interview with the Dalai Lama in the Rolling Stone magazine from just a couple of weeks ago. I've added it. It was a lovely interview with Melissa Matheson, who is the screenwriter of Kundun, the Martin Scorsese film about the life of the Dalai Lama. And a terrific interview, and I had omitted it from the bibliography, but I've replaced it. So if you go to the blog now, you'll find it and the link to it. lastly, I noticed I said and a lot in the first podcast. I listen to it to sort of take notes on some things I can improve on in the future. And I'm working on that aspect of mindful speech, not using those as bumpers between the things I say, but it's a hard practice to, or rather not a hard practice, a hard habit to unbreak. So I'm working on it, and I hope it's not as jarring for you as it was for me. I practiced forgiveness of myself for that, but I also had the thought of a famous episode of the Simpsons when Homer Simpson hears his own voice recorded and he screams in terror. And it wasn't that bad when I heard the podcast, but I was a little and there I just did it again, a little alarmed at how often I said and throughout the podcast. So I promise you I will work on that in the future. And lastly, I wanted to talk about a very sweet note I received from Charles Prebisch, whom I mentioned in the first podcast. One of Chuck's books that he edited, Buddhism, A Modern Perspective, is one of the books I mentioned would be a resource for the work that we'll be doing, and in particular my own looking elsewhere for help on certain issues that come up as we go through Buddhist religions. And Chuck was very sweet about the podcast, and then he just, typical of such a humble guy, he said, Buddhism, A Modern Perspective isn't so modern anymore. And I know what he means, that there have been very significant developments since that book was written in terms of our understanding of certain aspects of Buddhist history and culture and the way of looking at those things, ways of looking at those things. But I find it helpful for a lot of reasons, one of which is the way it's organized. I love that you have these sort of bites of these very important figures, texts, issues, trends, movements, schools, traditions. And it's not so exhaustive that it's like a slog to read. And it's also incredibly accessible. When my grandmother was alive, she asked me for a good book on Buddhist history, and she wanted to know more about what I was interested in. And I recommended this one, Buddhism, A Modern Perspective, edited by Charles Prebisch, because I felt that it, of all the kind of books talking about Buddhist history and sort of presenting it, it did the most accessible job. You could have zero background knowledge, experience of Buddhism and pick it up, and it's extremely coherent and not written in such a way that you feel like you have to have a degree in religious studies to follow along. I think it's a tremendous book. I will be mindful as we move on to draw from it, but also note when things have been updated or changed in our understanding of some of these things. But it's an incredibly helpful book, and I think I might have mentioned last week, it's also effectively a fetch shrift for Richard H. Robinson, who was the original author of this book. And as going backwards for a moment, one other mistake I made, even though I knew this, I misspoke. Richard H. Robinson, when he died, he was injured in this explosion that I mentioned, but he lived for about a month afterwards. And Chuck made a point of saying this. And if you want to know more about Robinson the man and you know, the importance of his work, I'm going to plug Chuck's brand new book, which is called An American Buddhist Life, Memoirs of a Modern Dharma Pioneer. And it's exactly what it sounds like, Chuck's memoir of a life in Buddhism and Buddhist studies. And it has a lot of wonderful kind of accounts and stories and dot connecting between a lot of Buddhist scholars and practitioners. And it's a lovely, lovely book, and I really recommend it. As I do Buddhism, A Modern Perspective, which we'll be using here. And so all of that said about Chuck's book, I would like to start today looking at one of the essays in it, which is Stephen V. Bayer's The Background to Buddhism. Now, in Buddhist religions, Robinson, Johnson, and Thanissaro Bhikkhu say this at the beginning of chapter one. And by the way, today we're going to be looking at chapter one, sections 1.1, the social and religious context of early Buddhism, and 1.2, issues in early North Indian thought. So right off the bat, the authors say, for Buddhists, the truth to which the Buddha awakened transcends the conditions of space and time. However, there is no denying that the social and cultural context in which he lived influenced the way he expressed his teachings and the way his contemporaries understood them. Now, this is a really important point, and Robinson, Johnson, and Thanissaro Bhikkhu do a fantastic job of sort of helping us understand what was going on at the particular time and place the Buddha was living. This isn't exactly a criticism because the arrangement of the book doesn't allow for this, perhaps, but I think we could go back even farther, and it will only help our understanding of what was going on in South Asia at the time of the Buddha's life and work. And to help us go back even farther, I find this piece, The Background of Buddhism, by Stephen V. Bayer in Prebisch's book, Buddhism, a Modern Perspective, extraordinarily helpful because it's so accessible and because it's so pithy. So I'm going to start by looking at that, and then when we finish, we'll move back into Buddhist religions here. So one of the things Stephen B. Bayer does in his piece is to really paint a sort of wonderful picture with as much as we know of the Indus Valley Civilization. Now, the Indus Valley Civilization was the ancient South Asian civilization that emerged in the Indus River Valley. And it would have sort of been in existence, taking shape by as far back as the 3rd millennium before the Common Era. So extremely old. And we actually have relics, artifacts, archaeological sites, other things from this culture. So we actually know a bit about it because we actually have some tangible relics and artifacts and things from that time to look at. If you've ever taken a class on world religions or even Hinduism or India, you've probably heard of the cities Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. And Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro are two of the oldest cities in the world that we have some archaeological evidence of. Harappa is in modern-day Punjab province in Pakistan, so not the Punjab state in India, but the Punjab province in Pakistan. And Mohenjo-Daro is in the Sindh province of Pakistan. So both of the cities are now in modern-day Pakistan. And these are sort of emblematic of the best qualities of these urban centers in the Indus Valley civilization. Neolithic, far-reaching in trade as far as Mesopotamia. Evidence of sort of a very sophisticated government and sort of urban organization. Writing, we're working on deciphering some of the writing from that time, written in stone. And it had these thriving urban centers at places like Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro. So really, really a kind of mighty civilization. Perhaps we don't know, I think generally school children in the United States maybe don't know as much about these ancient Indian civilizations as they do about, you know, ancient Egypt or ancient Greece or these places. But, really fascinating and tremendous in terms of giving us a glimpse into the ancient world. So again, as I said, it's as old at least as the 3rd millennium BCE, before the Common Era. And we see evidence of the cities like Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro crumbling by about 1200 BCE. And this seems to be due to civil war, invasion, war with, you know, just there seemed to have been a lot of destruction, so that's what we seem to think about what happened there. But in this period between, you know, around the third millennium and 1200 BCE, the third millennium BCE and 1200 BCE, we have this sort of picture of not only the sort of socioeconomic and sociopolitical structure of things in the Indus Valley civilization, but we also have this picture of Indus religion. And Bayer points out, you know, a few things that he thinks are, that we all think are pretty significant about what's been found and seen at Harappa and Mohenjo-Daro and everywhere else, and what they kind of say to us about Indian religion in the Indus Valley civilization. So among other things, archaeologists have found what seem to be large ritual baths. And these seem to suggest, as Bayer says, a very focused attention and importance being placed on purity of the body. And hand in hand with that, we see water as being very important in and of itself. It has a rich symbolic significance, but also, you know, was considered very important in and of itself. They seem to have shared with the Near East a worship of a mother goddess. We see some, you know, relics and artifacts that suggest this to us in the way that a particular woman or women are depicted. They seem to have been associated also with horned animals. We see a lot of focus on horned animals with these women, and also with trees. Trees seem sacred. There seem to be interactions in drawing and sculpture and things that suggest trees played a very, very central role in the sacred and religious life. And lastly, he points out phallic objects seem important, and they seem to be obvious offerings to the goddess, as well as symbolic of growth and fertility. So that's what we can know about the Indus Valley civilization's sort of religious life, what it looked like. These are some good clues that we have. And Bayer points out here that much of this is absorbed into Indian religion broadly. In fact, as you're listening, you know, if you know things about Indian thought and religion, then these things, there may have been sort of bells ringing for you in terms of certain things that I mentioned, like, you know, the phallus. I'm thinking of the Shiva Lingam and other things like that. So you may have had similar bells go off. And he also points out that we can sort of see this broad influence even in Buddhism. And he points out that in early Buddhism, spirits of streams and trees are central figures. And, you know, again, this is very much in keeping with water and trees seeming to have been very significant in the Indus Valley civilization. And certainly, you know, in Buddhism we have the Bodhi tree, under which the Buddha sat and attained enlightenment. So, you know, Bayer sees these as significant, that it's very purposeful almost in a way that trees and these water spirits and streams and stuff become important because it's consistent with sacredness as this ancient Indus Valley civilization would have thought of it. Now, so we have this civilization that's crumbled by 1200 before the Common Era. Then we have Indo-European invaders who arrive on the scene. And as Bayer points out, they're warriors who brought with them sky gods, a sort of a pantheon of gods who live in the sky, this sort of polytheistic religious tradition. They also bring with them families of religious professionals who do things like recitation of sacred hymns and rituals. And they also bring with them a psychotropic substance called soma, which produces states of ecstasy, and also it's thought in this Indo-European civilization, magical powers. Now, this Indo-European kind of religious culture that's taking shape, and I'm sort of talking as it's taking shape here between about 1200 before the Common Era and 600 before the Common Era, which is right about the time the Buddha will appear on the world stage. To understand how these are significant, you have to understand them sort of very much together. And I think Bayer is exceptionally helpful here in pointing this out. You know, and he says, you know, basically what these religious professionals would do is imbibe soma, which was thought to give them some ability to not only offer rituals and praise and appeal to and influence the gods, but actually control them. It was hence the sort of magical powers attributed to soma. It was thought that if they took them and then went through these hymns and rituals and things that they brought with them, they would be able to actually control the gods. And Bayer has a great phrase here that he uses, which I think is, you know, sort of perfect, where he says it basically is a complex magical simulacra. So that's what we have going on here. And this is the sort of, these are the important pieces of religious life in this Indo-European invading culture. And as Bayer says, this visionary tradition was early formulated into orally transmitted texts. And so Bayer breaks down these this Vedic literature, these Brahmanyas, into basic texts and expositions. And in the category of basic texts, we have basically a body of literature that he, you know, suggests was composed before the first millennium before the Common Era. And these include the threefold sacred knowledge. And this includes the Rig Veda, which I mentioned last week, which is an anthology of the hymns that were sung by these priestly families. And of course, this this hereditary class of people are Brahmins in the caste system, which we're going to hear a little bit more about here in a second. The second was the Yajurveda, which are the magical formulas sort of put in utterance form. And then the third of the threefold sacred knowledge body is the Sama Veda. And these are verses and melodies for Brahmin figures who would basically be like cantors. That's the comparison that Bayer makes, cantors in the rabbinical tradition. So you get verse and melody in the Sama Veda. And then there's also a fourth body of literature called the Atharva Veda. And these are, this is sort of a body of literature about magically averting evil, is how Bayer puts it. So in the expositions, which are, you know, sort of solidified around 800 before the Common Era, these include the Aranyakas, which are, it's essentially a body of literature based on realizations from solitary practitioners who go off into the forest, so forest yogis, basically. So it's like the special knowledge that they've attained, you know, put down. And then you also have this body of literature, which I imagine most of you have probably heard of before, called the Upanishads. And the skipping out of Bayer here for a minute and going back to Buddhist religions, Robinson, Johnson, and Tanisara Bhikkhu help us kind of understand the Upanishads a little bit and what they say. What they write is, the Upanishads essentially contain speculations on the origin and nature of the cosmos. And this is a verbatim quote from the book. They say, in addition to the canonical Upanishads, so many non-canonical Upanishads were composed that they came to form a separate body of texts. Now, the authors also sort of point out that there are several things that kind of connect these canonical and non-canonical Upanishads. And, you know, here's what they say. One is that the cosmos is derived from Brahma, who is conceived either as an anthropomorphic god or as a living principle, in their words. And he's described as, or it, Brahma, is described as giving birth to the cosmos, and this is another direct quote, through a process analogous to that of Vedic ritual. So, you know, interestingly, these rituals are sort of imitating, striving for the ritual that Brahma undertook to create the cosmos. And the other strand that they see is that the Brahmins are a caste as descended who are thought to descend from the mouth of Brahma, whereas the other castes are descended from the lower parts of Brahma. So this puts Brahmins at a much higher status in the caste system, and indeed, in the caste formation, Brahmins are at the very top, with what are called untouchables, quote unquote, at the bottom. Now, Bayer adds a couple of things to this conversation about the content of the Upanishads, and you know, one thing he sees as important is transmigration, this idea of rebirth and reincarnation. And also he sort of kind of fills out this idea of Brahma a little bit more and refers to it as the One. And basically what we get in the Upanishads is this formation of there in this great ultimate sense we have Brahma, who's this sort of Godhead kind of figure. But in a more kind of immediate relative sense, Brahma is understood through Atman, so sort of our individual soul consciousness, this sort of thing. So there's sort of this one Brahma has sort of two pieces, one being much more immediate and relative, and one being a little bit more, I guess, sort of esoteric and ultimate. Bayer also talks about one of the utterances in the Upanishads, which is Tat Tvam Asi, which means you are that, or Brahmo Am, which means I am Brahma. So this idea of you are that and I am Brahman, sort of help put this into perspective a little bit. You have these recitations, these utterances that kind of explain this idea of the One that Bayer, I think, does a good job of explaining here. And I'm going to read, jumping back and forth between Stephen V. Bayer and Buddhist religions, but I'm going to go back to Bayer again for a second to read an important section he has in his write-up called The Vedic Inheritance. So this is a short paragraph, and I'm just going to read it in its entirety because it's helpful. He writes, "Such teachings were of paramount importance for developing Buddhism. Buddha's own enlightenment was a visionary and ecstatic experience in the mythic mode of the earliest Vedic tradition. The doctrine of transmigration is central to the Buddhist quest, and the idea of nirvana would be unintelligible without it. The Buddhist process of insight meditation is a direct continuation of the meditations on the great sayings of the Upanishads, wherein the practitioner internalizes a concise doctrinal formula as a direct and personal realization of the truth. However much the metaphysical superstructure may have differed, and it differed considerably, the quest for freedom as a state of being within the phenomenal world and the contemplative techniques used in the search were inherited from the Vedic tradition." So that's an important thing to say, and I think Bayer says it very well as we look at this material about the Vedic tradition as sort of buttressing our understanding of the Buddha and his teaching. So now I think I'm going to jump back mostly to Buddhist religions, although I may have a digression or two involving Bayer. So let's jump to 600, you know, the 6th century before the Common Era, so that we're right in the period at which the Buddha is born and will do his teaching. And as the authors Robinson, Johnson, and Tanisura Bhikkhu say in Buddhist religions, this is a pretty remarkable moment for life in the Ganges plain, where sort of in the area where the Buddha is born and does most of his teaching. As they say, this sort of system of absolute monarchs was developing sort of new urban centers with, you know, lots kind of happening in them, more developing, more sort of excitement in the ancient Indian world, I suppose. And so they talk about how this economy starts to rise, this new economy starts to rise and thrive. And here's just a quick sentence that the authors say that kind of puts some things in perspective for the Buddha's life story. They were supplanting the clan-based agrarian republics of the traditional aristocratic and religious elites. So we'll talk about the life story of the Buddha next week, but one of the things, you know, that's important here is you have his father, the Buddha's father, King Suddhodana, who is the leader of this clan known as the Shakyas, sort of, you know, in and around the Ganges plain. And so he's sort of a figurehead in one of these clan-based agrarian republics in this kingdom called Magadha. So, you know, this kind of helps us understand, you know, the Buddha was sort of a quintessential son of his time in a way. But maybe this will make more sense next week. And so they point out, as does Stephen V. Bayer, that essentially when we're looking at religious culture at the time, we see sort of two phenomena. And one is people sort of hewing very close, you know, just following to the letter, essentially, this this Vedic tradition that we've been talking about, and then those who were not. So, you know, we've spoken about sort of the Vedic tradition here, and, you know, the authors perhaps even, you know, put it even more pithy, in a more pithy way than Bayer, by saying, you know, you had this system where, quote, the belief developed that the gods had no choice but to obey a ritual properly performed. And then in this second camp, you have these people known as shramanas. And shramanas literally means strivers, as the authors point out. And essentially, these were people who rejected everyday normal life at the time and instead embraced the life of a wandering ascetic. And the authors write, whether the shramanas were a resurfacing of a pre-Aryan religious movement or an anti-Vedic upsurge from within the Aryan tradition or a combination of both, no one knows for sure. So they lived in what the authors called these quote-unquote fluid communities, which could take the form of ashrams in the forest or something less less organized, and they often, you know, studied with profoundly realized masters. And the authors sort of end the paragraph about the shramana movement just sort of pointing out that the Buddha himself, you know, became a shramana at 29 and then sort of one of the masters within this shramana movement. So that's important that to know later that the Buddha definitely falls into this camp. And as we go through the life story next week, it's going to be, I think, incredibly obvious that fact that he's not part of the, in this split, he's not part of the following the Vedic tradition to the letter. He's part of this new movement of rejecting that and going in search of something else. Stephen B. Bayer makes an interesting point here about an issue within sort of, I guess, theology in shramana movements. And he sort of points out that there would have been a division between a sort of crowd of people who believed in, quote-unquote, freedom in transcendence, meaning getting away from the world as much as possible, sort of a sense of escape from everyday things, you know, really, you know, an idea of purity that gets past the mundane in our world. And then there would have been this crowd that saw, quote-unquote, freedom in imminence, meaning a sort of enormous possibility in encountering the phenomenal world and, I suppose, in a sense, being in it but not of it, as they say, but in a sort of rich, realized, deeply spiritual sense of that. And that's, I think, an important note, that there, the Sramana movement was not this monolithic thing. It was incredibly diverse, as it's, I hope it's becoming clear, many things in the Buddhist world are. So that's an important note from Bayer. Now, I'd like to shift to the section 1-2 of chapter 1, the issues in North Indian thought. And here's one of the things that the authors write. Robinson, Johnson, and Tanisura Bhikkhu, that is. Early Buddhist thought was defined not only by the answers it gave to the questions of its day, but also by its choices of which questions to answer and not answer. And so the authors point out that there were, you know, a great many philosophical questions that were being explored by religious thinkers at this time. And it is important to note that the Buddha addressed some of them, but certainly not all of them. And then, as they say, there's a lot being communicated in that, in what he rejects. And in fact, we'll look later at a particular Buddha story in which the Buddha does not respond to certain questions, and it's very purposeful and instructive that he does that. So among other things, you know, the questions that the authors sort of throw out that were being kind of batted around at the time were, is the cosmos eternal or not? Finite or not? Is the soul the same thing as the body or something separate? Do people who have reached the religious goal exist after death? Do they not exist? Both? Neither? Does everything exist? Is everything a oneness or a plurality? Do I exist? Do I not exist? What am I? And so again, as we go on, we'll look at some of the questions of these questions, which ones the Buddha addressed directly and which ones he did not. Although the authors do sort of tip their hand here and say, the position distinguishing Buddhism most markedly from other schools of thought was on the issue of karma, or intentional action. Now again, we'll be spending a lot of time talking about the issue of karma as we go on here, but I think it's helpful in terms of making this point to look at yet another book. I'm going to bring in a new one. This one is a relatively recent book by the great Theravada Buddhism scholar Richard Gombrich, and it's called What the Buddha Thought. Not to be confused with What the Buddha Taught by Walpole Rahula, a sort of famous introductory text to Buddhism. Title, in fact, is a play on that that title. But Gombrich, it's a terrific book. I really recommend it. And in fact, I'm even considering this. This could maybe be a follow-up to Buddhist Religions whenever we finish it. But one of the chapters of the book is called The Antecedents of the Karma Doctrine in Brahmanism. And over this chapter, you know, Gombrich, I think, is really does a sensational job of kind of underscoring how exactly Buddhism was, in the words of Robinson, Johnson, and Tarnasara Bhikkhu, most markedly distinguished from other schools of thought on the point of karma. And he writes, the primary purpose of Brahmin ritual was to purify, and for Brahmins, punya karma meant, quote, purifying act, i.e., rite of purification. This term the Buddha redefined as good or meritorious action, the sole criterion for which was morally good intention. Perhaps the commonest of all Buddhist words for vice, kilesa, literally means defilement. And we are dealing with the same metaphor. A bad person's mind is said to be dirty. Buddhist discourse is permeated by talk of purity and purification, but invariably that is a metaphor which refers to improving one's mind ethically and in due course intellectually, for the Buddha considered intelligence to be a virtue. In ritual, acts are enjoined or prohibited according to the agent. What is right for a man may be wrong for a woman, and vice versa. What is right for a Brahmin may be wrong for an outcast, etc. Norms are thus particularized, not universal. If they are universal, the moral value of an act, whether positive or negative, lies only in the act itself and is not affected by who the agent is. Buddhism both ethicized karma and universalized it. One could claim, however, that these steps had already been taken by Jainism, and he, in his next chapter, he talks about that, and we'll touch on that here in just a moment. Now, I think he was clear about what he meant by universalized there. Ethicized may be less clear, and he uses a definition of ethicized here from Gananath Obeyasekera in his book Imagining Karma, and this is what Obeyasekera says, or Sekere says here. I use the term ethicization to conceptualize the processes whereby a morally right or wrong action becomes a religiously right or wrong action that in turn affects the person's destiny after death. Ethicization deals with a thoroughgoing religious evaluation of morality that entails delayed punishments and rewards quite unlike the immediate or this worldly compensations meted out by deities or ancestors. So I think what Gombrich has done here by making this point about ethicizing and universalizing karma is exactly what, in many ways, I think, what Robinson Johnson and Thanissaro Bhikkhu are getting at when they say it so much distinguishes Buddhism from other systems of religious thought at the time. Okay, so moving on, Robinson Johnson and Thanissaro Bhikkhu write, by first millennium BCE, North Indian thought had accepted the notion, based on astronomers' calculations of planetary cycles, that time is measured in eons, incomprehensibly long cycles that repeat themselves endlessly. The thinkers of the time presented their views on the potential of human action against this vast temporal frame, but differed widely in their interpretations of its role. The authors go on to say that these differences sort of pivot on two specific issues, one being personal identity. And they note that most of the Brahmanical and Tramana schools agreed that the person's identity extends through these countless eons in the cycle of samsara, which is repeated birth, death, and rebirth. And as they say, the real disagreement was about what exactly constituted identity and whether it changed through this huge cycle of time or essentially remained the same. They also note that by the time of the Buddha, most people seem to be on the same page that happiness, liberation, etc., kind of hinged on getting off of the cycle, you know, reaching the end of the cycle, you know, being propelled out of it somehow. The authors also note that at the time there was a, I guess, influential enough that we know something about them, hedonist materialist shramana group called the Lokayata, and they denied any existence beyond death. And basically, their only kind of seems their only message was the thing you want to do is just completely indulge yourself sensually. That's just what we're supposed to do. So there's a lot going on here with regards to personal identity and how we're supposed to respond accordingly based on what we know. The next area is causality, and the authors point out that there seem to, again, be some agreement about human action playing a causal role in terms of achieving happiness in this life and throughout the samsaric continuum. But the authors point out views about how the causal principle worked or what exactly the causal principle was, there was enormous diversity around that. Here they mention the Jains and sort of point out that they felt that all action was sort of subject to these very deterministic causal laws. You know, as they say, quote, the past shaped the present, which in turn shaped the future. According to them, the only escape from the cycle lay in a life of nonviolence and inaction, culminating in suicide by starvation. End of quote. They mentioned that some of the Upanishads talked about causality in this kind of neutral and largely physical sense that it was a kind of evolutionary process. Other Upanishads stated that, quote, moral laws are intrinsic to the nature of causality rather than being mere social conventions, and that the morality of an action determines how it affects one's future course in the round of rebirth. So again, you know, they sort of point out all this diversity and end saying, quote, at any rate, all pre-Buddhist thinkers who accepted the principle of causality, however they expressed it, viewed it as a strict linear process. X causes Y, which in turn causes Z, but neither Y nor Z feed back to have an influence on X. So that's the sort of mathematical formula for kind of, you know, again, these pre-Buddhist thinkers who accepted the principle of causality, however they did. And again, they make some, they give some airtime to the Lokiyatas, who felt that actions had, you know, zero consequence, and you know, you could sort of safely ignore any idea of morals and ethics in your pursuit of sensual pleasure. Sounds very convenient to be a Lokiyata, I must say. But that's not very, I suppose, pluralistic or inclusivistic of me. They also talk about another shramana school called the Ajivikas, who, you know, they only note were sort of distinguished by having this specialization in divination and astrology. They sort of looked at things in this kind of cruel fate sort of way. They said, one branch of the Ajivikas thought that human action and agency were completely unreal. And another branch maintained that action was real but totally predetermined. Either way you look at it, they felt that morality was basically a social convention. And there wasn't much you could do other than just sort of wait it out and see what your fate was going to be. I suppose it was very Augustinian in that regard. You know, that there's really nothing you can do. You can't know if you're one of the sort of, you know, the one of God's chosen in the sort of Augustinian worldview. You just sort of have to kind of stand by and see what happens when you die. I think, you know, similarly here, it just sort of seems like there's, you know, kind of little that's within your sphere of control in this Ajivika sort of way of looking at things. Okay, we'll wrap up here. The last sort of statement of the authors in this section is, again, another thing I want to read in full, and it's just two sentences here. The divergent viewpoints of these two issues form the backdrop for Siddhartha Gautama's quest for ultimate happiness. In fact, his awakening may be viewed as his own resolution of these issues, which provided a view of the role of human action, seen in the light of personal survival and causal principles, that proved influential for many centuries afterwards, both in northern India and beyond. So again, I hope this was helpful, you know, to just sort of sum up, you know, we have this Indus Valley civilization that places, you know, great emphasis on purity, mother goddess, water, trees. They're sort of beginning to be replaced by around 1600 before the Common Era by the Vedic tradition, and by 1200 before the Common Era, they've kind of completely fallen into disarray, and this Indo-European Aryan thing with the Vedic tradition comes in, you know, and in the Vedic tradition you have the caste system, this view of Brahman, the one, you know, this ritual being extremely important. And then by the time of the Buddha's life, around the 6th century of before the Common Era, you have the Vedic tradition strongly established, but then also this movement of radical new thinkers who want completely out of the system, the worldview, the culture, and are sort of doing their own thing, looking for their own answers to the problems of the world, and into this community, this very diverse, expansive community, comes the Buddha. So we'll find out a little bit about who this Buddha character is starting next week. We've had 2 weeks now of podcasts, and we've yet to hear about this figure at the center of the Buddhist religions. So I'm very much looking forward to talking about the story of the Buddha's life next week. It's probably my favorite story, and I think certainly a powerful one, whether you're listening as just someone interested to know more about Buddhism or Buddhist practitioner. I think many of us can agree that it's an inspiring story, a challenging story. So I'm very excited. And again, we could have done a lot more with just talking about the origin of Indian religious thought up to the Buddha's life. So I hope this wasn't too quick and dirty, and that it was relatively helpful. Please leave questions if you've got questions. You can put them in the comments of the blog if there was something that was unclear. I'd really like to be able to address these things. Please know that that's something I would hate for you to be at home and say, oh, I don't really know what he meant by that, but let's just move on. So with that, may you all be happy, may you all be well, and may you all be peaceful.